Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The flap of the red tent opened. A man stepped through, his neatly trimmed beard framing a handsome face shadowed by a large white turban. He was approaching middle age, fit and strong, and he owned an air of command born of many years spent issuing orders and seeing them obeyed. His sparkling eyes radiated charisma, but despite his obvious competence, his air of well-earned superiority, a bit of fear showed on that well-made face. The man's name was Sheikhzade Mustafa, Prince Mustafa, the son and most likely successor of the Ottoman Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. Mustafa had come here, to the valley of Eregli in central Anatolia, to meet his father on September 21st, 1553. But as he entered the tent, full of confidence and just a touch of apprehension, Mustafa knew something was amiss. He didn't see his father, the aging sultan in his enormous white turban. Instead, a curtain blocked off much of the tent's interior. Three men were waiting for him, mute, strongly built figures. One of them carried a bowstring in his gnarled, powerful hands. Mustafa knew immediately why they were here and what the bowstring was for. His father intended this meeting to be his son's end. The three mutes, the sultan's favored executioners, wordlessly threw themselves at Mustafa. Two grabbed at his arms, trying to hold him, while the third wrapped the bowstring around his neck to strangle him. The prince fought back. He punched and kicked, threw off his attackers, untangled himself from the bowstring, and looked around for anything he could use as a weapon. The struggle kicked over tables, sending cups and crockery flying. Broken noses and gashed faces dripped blood onto the expensive, richly woven carpets covering the ground. Mustafa managed to break the mute's grip and stood, wondering whether he could escape outside, where the army's janissaries might see his plight and support him against his father. But before he could move, he saw a face appear above the curtain. It belonged to Suleiman. Lined with age, the beard shot through with gray, the eyes cold and impassive. The sultan betrayed no emotion at what was happening to his son. Seeing Suleiman and fearing his displeasure, the executioners redoubled their efforts. They forced Mustafa to the ground and managed to get the bowstring back around his neck. The thick, corded muscles in the executioner's arms and shoulders stood out as he pulled and pulled and pulled still more on the bowstring, until Mustafa finally stopped struggling, his gurgling cry cut off at last. The sultan stepped out from behind the curtain, his thin, pale face in a motionless mask, and he motioned to the sweating, heaving, bloody executioners. They picked up the corpse and deposited it outside the tent for everyone to see. The janissaries, the pashas, the viziers, everybody would know that Suleiman would tolerate no treachery, real or imagined. Even his gifted, intelligent, capable son could receive no leniency. Suleiman had ruled the Ottoman Empire for 33 years, and he would keep on ruling it until the day he died. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The Ottoman Empire was the superpower of the 15th and 16th centuries. No other European state could match its seemingly limitless resources, the professionalism and discipline of its armies, or the centralizing authority of its sultans. No Ottoman ruler did more, or enjoyed a more exalted reputation, than Suleiman the Magnificent. The Grand Turk, as some of his Christian rivals called him, ruled the Ottoman Empire for 46 years, from 1520 to 1566. During that time, his armies marched on Vienna and Baghdad. His fleets cruised in the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, the Black Sea, and the westernmost reaches of the Mediterranean. His ambassadors carried his will east to the Spice Islands of Asia, south down the coast of East Africa, and to the cold reaches of Northern Europe. He had eyes and ears everywhere, and only had to snap his fingers to affect the course of events on three continents. Suleiman's reign has traditionally been seen as the high point of the Ottoman Empire, its apex and apogee. From one point of view, called the Ottoman decline thesis, everything afterward was part of a long, slow process of decay and deterioration that lasted until the empire finally fell apart in the aftermath of the First World War. This is straightforwardly wrong. The Ottomans remained a first-rate power well into the 18th century and hung on for two more centuries after that. But in key ways, Suleiman's reign did represent a turning point in the broader scheme of Ottoman history. Things did change in ways that later commentators, close observers of and participants in the Ottoman system themselves, understood as a decline. It would behoove us to understand those changes and why they seemed bad, and precisely how and why they were rooted in the glories of Suleiman's reign. Last time on Tides, we talked about Suleiman's achievements as a conqueror. Belgrade and Rhodes, the crushing victory over the Hungarians at Mohacs, the setback at Vienna, the taking of Baghdad, and then how Suleiman humiliated the Habsburgs in the Mediterranean and in Central Europe. Today, we'll shift the focus to some of Suleiman's non-conquering achievements, of which there were many. We'll talk about the dynastic politics and instabilities of Suleiman's reign, his relationship with his household and family. And finally, we'll try to understand what all that has to do with golden ages and declines. When we left Suleiman in the last episode, he had just signed a peace treaty with the Habsburgs in the aftermath of years of successful campaigning in Hungary and the Mediterranean. Despite spending a whole episode on it, we still haven't covered the entirety of Suleiman's military and territorial grasp. He launched two more major campaigns against Persia, one in 1548 and another in 1553. Suleiman never brought Takhmasp, the Safavid Shah and son of the legendary Ismail, to battle. He also never succeeded in winning the kind of crushing victory that his father had at Chaldiran in 1514. The territorial gains were limited to some land around Lake Van in the Armenian highlands of what's now eastern Turkey, and a few other minor gains between Georgia and Azerbaijan. The treaty that ended the wars eventually did confirm Ottoman possession of Iraq and an outlet on the Persian Gulf, but they'd already had that. But there was one really important thing that happened over the course of the final Persian campaign. The execution of Sheikhzade Mustafa, the eldest son of Suleiman, for the supposed crime of conspiring against his father. That was the scene we saw back at the beginning of the episode, the horrifying strangling of the son in his father's presence and at his father's command. Was Mustafa really plotting against his father? Maybe, maybe not. But the incident tells us a great deal about Suleiman's later years and the future path of the Ottoman Empire. By fully understanding why a father would have his most capable son murdered, we'll come to understand the changing circumstances in which Suleiman and his empire found themselves. It's a fitting starting point for our discussion today. The Ottoman Empire in 1553 was not the Ottoman Empire that Suleiman had inherited in 1520. Even less the one his father Selim had taken by force in 1512, and definitely not the empire that his grandfather Bayezid had plotted and schemed to acquire in 1481. Their Ottoman Empire, this Ottoman Empire of the past, had been, at its core, a conquest state. The Sultan's fundamental role was as a war leader, preferably against religiously acceptable targets, either Christians or Muslims defined as heretics, like the Safavids. And the Sultan was generally expected to lead his armies in person wherever possible. These major campaigns harnessed the might of the empire to a singular purpose. Even more than that, they bound the empire's most dangerous elements, the standing army, the high officials, and the frontier lords, to the Sultan, preferably in person and with shared goals in mind. When the Sultan set off for Hungary or Persia with his cannon and his janissaries and his sipahis and all his powerful officials, that meant those folks weren't plotting against him or against each other. Even more than that, the new conquests that resulted from these campaigns provided the means of paying off the troops, rewarding loyal officials, and paving the way for still more wars of acquisition. This was an age of huge budget surpluses. Plunder and tribute payments filled the Ottoman coffers to the point of overflowing. But Suleiman's reign saw the last major conquests of this kind, the type that had fueled the Ottoman state since its inception in the early 14th century. A conquest state, and one whose goal is stable rulership of a defined territory, are much different beasts. That was the fundamental transformation of Suleiman's reign, and at heart, the reason for this pervasive idea of Ottoman decline. Consider Suleiman on the field at Mohaj, armor scarred from Hungarian lance blows and coolly supervising the beheading of prisoners. Now imagine his son and eventual successor Selim II, locked away in the Topkapi Palace in Istanbul, surrounded by eunuchs and the women of the harem. The difference is striking. But why was it Selim II who eventually came to rule and not Mustafa? Mustafa was a capable man with all the makings of a great ruler of the Ottoman Empire. To all appearances, he was cut from the same mold as a long line of great padishahs, from Mehmed the Conqueror to Selim the Grim to his glittering father. Intelligent and well-educated, prepared to rule with a succession of lesser offices, skilled at military strategy and undeniably courageous in personal combat, popular among the provincial Sipahis and Anatolian Turkomans, respected by the battle-hardened Janissaries. Those were the qualities that Suleiman's successor could use to crush the Safavids, extend Ottoman rule to Vienna and beyond, and make another attempt on Italy. Mustafa looked like a born conqueror, a man ready to wield the power of his father's empire and take it further than ever. What wasn't to like? We have to remember that conflict within the ruling dynasty was baked into the Ottoman system. It had been there since the very beginning. The guiding principle was unigeniture, the idea that only one heir could succeed to the throne. None of the potential successors, the many sons of the Sultan, received any explicit preference. Now the Sultan might prefer or dislike one of his heirs. He might give one son prime governorships and keep another away from the possibility of military glory. He could effectively exile a prince to a distant province or make him unpopular by forcing him to deal with revolts or issues of tax collection. But at the end of the day, as the Sultan aged or after he died, as his sons got older and closer to the throne, the heirs would have to fight it out among themselves. The result was constant jockeying for position. Each son sought out bases of support, whether that was the religious establishment, the ulama, powerful frontier lords and governors, the sanchak beys, the viziers of the palace, the janissaries and their agas, their commanders, or even the disaffected and disloyal elements out in the provinces. All of them could offer something to a potential Ottoman ruler. Each contender over the past decades and centuries had tried to maneuver them into supporting his bid. Bayezid II, Suleiman's grandfather, had relied on the support of the frontier lords and the religious establishment against the Grand Vizier. Selim the Grim had had the Janissaries. Neither Selim nor Bayezid II had been his father's favorite, ironically enough, but that actually made a certain kind of sense. Any heir who had the genuine potential to rule the Ottoman Empire was bound to clash with a father who had already proven himself capable of doing so. In Selim's case, his father had died quite conveniently after he made his bid for the throne. There were persistent rumors that Bayezid II had poisoned his father, Mehmet the Conqueror. So, if you were Suleiman the Magnificent, 58 years old in 1553, ruler of the Ottoman Empire for 33 years, and you had this ambitious, capable son, you might start to wonder what he had in store for you. That was the Ottoman way, survival of the fittest. Only one could rule. So far, everything between Mustafa and Suleiman looked normal, insofar as the ongoing tension between dynastic and familial rivals for rulership over 15 million people and a huge state was concerned. If we were using the past as a guide, we could expect them to test one another while Mustafa attempted to kill or sideline his brothers, and maybe hasten his father on his way to paradise. But that's not how it turned out. Instead, Suleiman grew convinced that Mustafa was plotting against him, and he was determined to do something about it. That was why he called Mustafa to join him in his tent that day in 1553. If Mustafa did so, then, well, he could be executed on the spot. If he refused, then it was proof of his treason. So how did Suleiman become convinced that Mustafa wanted to get rid of him? It's not at all clear, but the consensus is that most of the blame falls on the Rustem Pasha, Suleiman's grand vizier, who told Suleiman that Mustafa planned to kill Rustem and use the janissaries and household sipahis to depose Suleiman. Even more, Rustem told Suleiman that Mustafa had made an alliance with Tahmasp, the Shah of Persia, to further this goal. Was any of it true? Princes making enemies of grand viziers wasn't unheard of. Selim the Grim had faced down his father's grand vizier on the way to the throne. What was different here was that the Grand Vizier succeeded in convincing Suleiman on the possibility, well, based on hearsay, that Suleiman's wife, Hürrem Sultan, helped make the decision for her husband. Hürrem Sultan, better known in the West as Roxolana, is a fascinating and unique figure. Ottoman rulers had kept many concubines, none of whom was supposed to be favored over the others, but Roxolana was different. In 1534, after she had borne Suleiman 6 children, he elevated her above the rest of the women of the harem and formally married her. This was unheard of. No Ottoman ruler had taken a legal wife in 2 centuries. Moreover, unlike the other mothers of Ottoman princes, Hürrem Sultan stayed in the capital after her sons came of age. She retained her influence over politics more generally, and Suleiman in particular. Now, Prince Mustafa, and this is key, was not her son, but the son of a previous favorite, and he was an obstacle to any of Hürrem's offspring inheriting the throne. Whether Hürrem was actually involved is impossible to definitively say. What's certain is that she had the motive to act in concert with Rüstem Pasha to get rid of Mustafa, and that Hürrem's sons were the ones who benefited the most from Mustafa's death. Regardless of whether he was planning anything in particular beyond the usual Ottoman succession struggles, Mustafa was a threat. He was a threat to Hürrem and her sons, neither of whom was anywhere near as impressive as the capable, brave, active Mustafa. He was a threat to Rüstem Pasha, who owed his career to Hürrem because a powerful heir presumptive took precedence over a mere slave, no matter how gifted and well-connected. And last of all, Mustafa was a threat to Suleiman. The janissaries and sipahis and frontier lords expected their ruler to go out on campaigns, to lead them in battle, to aggressively conquer new lands. Mustafa could do that. Suleiman, nearly 60 years old in 1553, increasingly could not. He hadn't been on a military expedition in 4 years and didn't really intend to go on anymore. He only went east in 1553 because of the threat he believed Mustafa posed. If he wasn't seen publicly doing the things a sultan was supposed to do, well, then he was effectively allowing his son to displace him and his brothers. Suleiman wasn't ready for that yet. But his lack of readiness to go and the rest of the circumstances surrounding Mustafa's death speak powerfully to the changing circumstances of the Ottoman Empire. We see increasingly powerful officials politicking with the sultan's wife. We see an aging sultan who no longer wanted to go on military campaigns and an active heir who did. That created real conflict over the proper role of the sultan. The janissaries expected the sultan to lead them into battle, as Ottoman rulers had done for centuries. What would happen if a ruler no longer wanted to or wasn't able to? That marked a fundamental shift in Ottoman rulership and the structure of the empire. After Mustafa's death, that was in fact what happened. Suleiman straggled out for only one more real campaign, the one on which he died in 1566. His son Selim never led a campaign. Neither did Selim's successors, not for a long time. In this sense, Mustafa was a throwback, the last representative of a particular kind of active, personal Ottoman rulership. The conquering sultan who led his janissaries and sipahis in person, who pitched his tent on battlefields in Hungary and Persia and beyond. There were no more of those after Suleiman. Had Mustafa succeeded his father, maybe he would have succeeded in keeping that style of rulership relevant and capable. But maybe the Ottoman Empire had grown too large. Maybe its business was too complex. Maybe its officials and concubines were too powerful to leave unsupervised while the sultan campaigned. Either way, Suleiman was the last sultan of that first age. The chance of more like him died in that tent with Mustafa.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying?
If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Mustafa's death may have been a real turning point. It's hard to say, given the contingency involved in these things, but it definitely has symbolic value. The old Sultan killing his most capable son, and with him the chance of a future that resembled the past. Within months of Mustafa's death, Suleiman's favorite son, the hunchbacked, intelligent, sensitive Jahangir, died as well, reportedly of sadness at the murder of his beloved brother. That left two of Hürrem Sultan's sons as possible contenders for the throne, Bayezid and Selim, neither of whom was their dead brother's equal. Now, everybody knew this. Mustafa had been an exceptionally popular figure, particularly with the army and the Janissaries, and Suleiman was obliged to dismiss Rüstem Pasha's grand vizier to silence the uproar. But it was a sign of how powerful his officials had become, how capable and how well-connected to his network of clients and key figures like Hürrem, that Suleiman brought Rüstem Pasha back into office just 2 years later. That would have been hard to imagine during the reigns of previous sultans. Viziers were powerful people. They often retained their own agendas, sometimes at odds with those of other important figures, like the princes. But ever since Mehmet the Conqueror had executed his father's powerful grand vizier, Çandarlı Halil Pasha, in 1453, none had openly wielded so much influence in the backdoor politicking that surrounded the sultan. The only one who had come close, Suleiman's great grand vizier and closest lifelong friend, Ibrahim Pasha, well, Suleiman had ordered him to be executed in 1536. The difference between Suleiman's decisive treatment of Ibrahim and his acceptance of Rüstem Pasha shows just how much things could change, even in 20 years. It's worth spending a little bit more time on this, and especially on Ibrahim Pasha. This is a deeply tragic story of ambition, betrayal, and the death of friendship, but also one that tells us a great deal about Suleiman himself and the empire he ruled. Ibrahim Pasha was born in what's now northwestern Greece, somewhere between 1493 and 1495, in territory that was then ruled by the Republic of Venice. His origins were humble. His family were Orthodox Christians, and his father was either a fisherman or a sailor. Ibrahim was taken from his home in a slave raid very early in life and eventually ended up in the household of a guy named İskender Pasha. İskender Pasha was the Sanchak Bey, the governor of Bosnia, and he belonged to a prominent family of Ottoman soldiers, governors, and statesmen. As with so many children, Ibrahim was forced to convert to Islam. His new masters educated Ibrahim and cultivated his talents, which turned out to be prodigious. Now, I've mentioned the Devşirme many times over the past few episodes. It was the official levy, or blood tax, of boys from Christian households who went on to become Janissaries, household sipahis, and the Sultan's servants. But that was just one manifestation of a deeper tendency within the Ottoman system, one that focused on culling talented boys, enslaving and converting them, and then letting them rise as far as their merits could take them. The Devşirme wasn't the only route through which talented figures could come up. Without being flippant or minimizing the oppression inherent in a slave-based system, the Ottomans were practically unique among European powers in the extent to which gifted youths of humble birth could rise. But there were exceptions. Henry VIII's powerful Lord Chancellor, Archbishop of York, and Cardinal, a guy named Thomas Wolsey, was probably the son of a butcher. But they were uncommon. The ranks of the Ottoman elite, by contrast, were full of low-born, gifted risers. And none of them rose higher than Ibrahim Pasha. Ibrahim first encountered Suleiman, who was almost exactly the same age, when the two were both young men. Suleiman was still a prince and took a liking to Ibrahim, who joined his household. It's understandable why. By all accounts, Ibrahim was handsome, exceptionally well-educated, extremely intelligent, and had a gift for languages. all Ottoman princes collected hangers-on, in large part what separated the successful candidates and future great rulers from those who fell by the wayside was whether those hangers-on were useful or not. Ibrahim proved to be very useful. As Suleiman rose and cemented his status as his father's only possible heir, he and Ibrahim grew closer and closer. After the early successes of his reign at Belgrade and Rhodes, Suleiman faced serious internal challenges in his newly acquired provinces of Syria and especially Egypt. Remember, Selim the Grim had essentially doubled the size of the Ottoman Empire, adding a huge chunk of the Muslim world's core to his state. Some instability was always going to be inevitable, and there was no guarantee that a ruler based in Istanbul was going to be able to hang on to territories, especially territories that had a long tradition of power and independence of their own. At the same time, Suleiman was getting his feet under him as a ruler. Slowly but surely, he was promoting his own officials to replace those he'd inherited from his father. Piri Mehmet Pasha had been Selim's final grand vizier, and a reasonably capable one, but his lack of support for the campaign to take Rhodes from the Hospitallers in 1522 had been the final nail in his career's coffin. He was put out to pasture with a pension in 1523. But instead of the second vizier, Ahmed Pasha, who was seen as the likeliest candidate for the job, Suleiman instead promoted his closest friend and associate, Ibrahim Pasha. Now, Ahmed Pasha didn't take this well. He had helped trigger Piri Pasha's ouster, assuming that he'd get the job next. But Suleiman had instead elevated the less experienced Ibrahim. Ahmed Pasha resigned his post as second vizier and asked to be assigned as governor of Egypt. This was granted, but once he was there, Ahmed Pasha plotted a rebellion. He was looking to separate Egypt from the rest of the Ottoman Empire. He cut deals with Mamluks, had the Janissary garrison massacred, and nearly succeeded before he was assassinated himself. Another rebellion broke out after Ahmed's death. Suleiman was in danger of losing Egypt and maybe the rest of his newly acquired possessions if something wasn't done. So the job fell to Ibrahim. The new Grand Vizier went first to Syria, where he reorganized the provincial administration and dealt with the last remnants of a rebellion from early in Suleiman's reign. Ibrahim ordered the execution of subpar officials and functionaries for good measure, and then carried the same formula to Egypt. The last rebels were either co-opted or beheaded, and the financial and bureaucratic governance was put on a firm foundation. It took Ibrahim less than a year to bring these two key regions firmly under Ottoman control, rooting out any hint of resistance to their new imperial ruler in Istanbul. Ibrahim was just getting started. He had proved himself to be indispensable already and grew even closer to Suleiman as his role grew. His bedroom was right next to Suleiman's. They exchanged letters constantly. When Ibrahim married, a member of an elite Ottoman family, in fact the one to whom he had first belonged as a slave, prior to his departure for Syria and Egypt, it was a lavish occasion. It was sponsored by Suleiman himself. On the field at Mohacs in 1526, Ibrahim helped formulate the Ottoman battle plan. When envoys arrived from the Habsburg Ferdinand, would-be ruler of Hungary, to negotiate settlements both before and after the siege of Vienna, well, it was Ibrahim who dealt with them. When the time came to carry the war to the east against the Safavids, it was Ibrahim who led those campaigns. But everything wasn't sunshine and roses. The Vienna campaigns of 1529 and 1532, masterminded by Ibrahim, were major disappointments. The outings against the Safavids succeeded in taking Baghdad and most of Iraq, but they cost a great deal of manpower. More worrisome for Ibrahim was the growing sense that he was overreaching himself, that he was taking on airs and an inflated sense of his own importance. Suleiman had left much of the governance of the empire in Ibrahim's hands between 1532 and 1535. Perhaps he had come to believe that he, not Suleiman, was the true ruler. He began to use the title of Sultan and talked Suleiman into executing a key financial official. Harem, by now Suleiman's wife and a major influence, also, for whatever reason, seems to have disliked Ibrahim. But in the end, it was Suleiman's empire, not Ibrahim's and not Harem's, and there could be only one ruler. Exercising real power, so nakedly, was an invitation for reprisal. The end came for Ibrahim on March 15, 1536. He had come to dinner with Suleiman the night before, as usual, and retired to his adjoining bedroom, just as he always did. The next morning, his corpse was found strangled to death, blood spattered onto the walls of his chambers. The bloodstains were kept as they were, a reminder to all of the fate that could befall even the most loyal, dedicated, and competent of the Sultan's servants. In life, Ibrahim Pasha had been known as Makbul, the favorite. In death, only one letter changed, Maktul, the executed. One letter was all the difference it required. The next several Grand Viziers were relative non-entities, and Suleiman largely took back control, at least until the rise of Rüstem Pasha. At that point, Rüstem, and perhaps more important, his alliance with Hürrem Sultan, Suleiman's wife, produced enough influence to approach what Ibrahim had been executed for 2 decades earlier. It was inevitable that the Sultan would have to delegate, and that he would be influenced by the powerful figures around him. Early in his reign, Suleiman had fought against that rising tide of responsibility and killed its personification in the form of his best, oldest, and, if we're being honest about it, his only friend, Ibrahim Pasha. Suleiman kept his hand on the wheel until the very end of his life, but for the last decade of his reign, he wasn't the only one steering the ship. That last decade, from about 1555 to 1566, was largely defined by the ongoing dynastic competition between Suleiman's 2 remaining sons, Bayezid and Selim. With the elimination of Mustafa, only Hürrem Sultan's sons remained eligible. Of the two, Bayezid was the first to stumble. When Suleiman ordered his 2 sons to take up the governorship of new provinces, Selim promptly obeyed. But Bayezid hesitated. That was enough for all parties involved. Suleiman threw his weight behind Selim, who defeated his brother in battle, thanks mostly to his father's troops and his father's general, Sokolu Mehmet Pasha. This left Selim, an indolent, controllable, inactive figure with a fondness for wine, as the frontrunner to inherit the throne. As in Suleiman's later years, the Grand Vizier, the same Sokolu Mehmet Pasha, and Selim's wife effectively ran the empire in partnership with one another. We'll come back to the implications of all this toward the end as we discuss the Ottoman decline thesis, but for now, what's important to remember here is this. Even though Ibrahim Pasha got himself executed, he still marked the beginning of what was a probably inevitable shift of power away from the Sultan himself and toward his broader household, namely the Grand Vizier and the Sultan's principal wife. Maybe this was inevitable. The Ottoman Empire had become too big to be ruled by any one person, no matter how gifted.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/business.
Suleiman did a lot more than win military victories and execute his family and friends. 2 things in particular stand out. First, while in the West, Suleiman's best-known epithet is the Magnificent, throughout the Muslim world, he's better known as Suleiman Kanuni, the lawgiver. While not nearly as emphasized in the Christian world, his greatest accomplishments in his subjects' eyes were his codifications of the law. No mere secular ruler could change the tenets of Sharia, the codes of behavior all Muslims were expected to follow and which ultimately derived from the Quran itself. There were, and are, multiple schools of interpretation, including Hanafi, Hanbali, Maliki, Shafi, and Jafari. The Ottomans mostly stuck to the Hanafi school. Ottoman qadis, judges, who administered the law throughout the empire, were trained in Hanafi-style fiqh, meaning jurisprudence. If Sharia was the law, fiqh was the interpretation of it. It wasn't an Ottoman sultan's job to change any of that. But law encompassed a lot more than Sharia, and actual practice required a lot more flexibility and detail than the Hanafi school could provide. The Ottoman system of criminal justice relied heavily on monetary fines, something that the Hanafi school allowed only with extreme reluctance, so it required modification. Moreover, most of the land in the Ottoman Empire wasn't private property or land subject to Sharia rules. It belonged to the Sultan, who dispensed it as he desired to his subjects. That was a whole area full of conflict that required legal regulation beyond what was readily available. Over the course of centuries of Ottoman rule, a bewildering variety of legal practices and precedents sprang up to fill these gaps. Sultans made occasional attempts to normalize and regulate them, most notably Mehmet the Conqueror, but their attention mostly fell elsewhere. But Suleiman was determined to do something about all this. He initiated a long and intense process of legal codification. He relied on a chief legal official, Sheikh Hulislam, named Ebu Suud Efendi, to carry out the painstaking, difficult work. The basic task was to reconcile the actual practice of law as it was carried out in day-to-day life, kanun, with the legal principles derived from Sharia, and particularly the Hanafi school. This was a gargantuan task. Ebu Suud Efendi remained in office for 3 decades, well into the reign of Suleiman's son Selim II, to get the job done. The Ottoman legal system was still a bit ramshackle compared to some of its contemporaries, but Suleiman's improvements made it drastically more systematic, logical, and easy to utilize for both petitioners and judges. That's one major additional facet of Suleiman's reign. Another connects back to what we've talked about with the Ottomans as a constituent part of Europe and European developments at this point in time. This, as you'll recall, was the Age of Exploration, the time when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, Vasco da Gama went to India, and the conquistadors did their awful work in the Caribbean, Mexico, and South America. At first glance, the Ottomans couldn't seem to be more distant from all that. They were a Mediterranean power, right? Well, not exactly. This was an age of exploration for the Ottomans, too. There's a great book on this topic called, obviously enough, The Ottoman Age of Exploration by Giancarlo Casale, and most of what follows draws on his work. So, according to Casale, 4 characteristics define the age of exploration. First, a starting point of relative geographic and political isolation. Second, the development of political ideologies focusing on trade routes and maritime navigation. Third, innovation in essential areas of military and naval technology. And finally, a deep intensification of intellectual interest in the distant world. Casale argues, pretty convincingly in my mind, that the Ottomans shared all of these characteristics in varying degrees. Prior to Selim the Grim's conquests in Syria and Egypt, remember that the Ottoman Empire was essentially a European power, or if you prefer, a two-front power, facing Anatolia and the Balkans, with a one-front army that was mostly directed at European Christians. After all, Europe was where the conquerable territory was and where the plunder was to be found. It was a lot more attractive than fighting semi-nomadic Turkomans in eastern Anatolia or slogging through the Kurdish lands, particularly with the powerful Mamluks to the south in Syria, the Levant and the Akkoyunlu in Iran in the east. Despite the fact that the Muslim world extended deep into Central and South Asia, the Ottomans didn't have much more contact with the Spice Islands and the Indian Ocean and China than the rest of the European world did. But that changed with Selim's conquests. He effectively doubled the size of the Ottoman Empire and made it the preeminent power in the Muslim world by conquering Syria and Egypt. The conquest of Egypt in particular dramatically expanded Ottoman horizons. Even after the Portuguese showed up, uninvited, in the Indian Ocean at the close of the 15th century, most of the spice trade still flowed west via Muslim merchants. Most of those Muslim merchants made their way from India to the Red Sea, then to Egypt and the Levant, from where the spices eventually reached Europe. By taking Egypt and the Levant, all of that was suddenly Ottoman business. Moreover, becoming the preeminent power in the Muslim world meant that protecting the pilgrimage routes to Mecca from India now fell under the Sultan's purview. In short, there were both material and ideological reasons for the Ottomans to take an increasing interest in what lay beyond their immediate view. We could spend an entire series discussing the Ottoman Age of Exploration. If the topic interests you, I highly recommend you take a look at Casale's book. Here, I just want to focus on some of the key manifestations of this greater Ottoman engagement with the wider world. First, just as their European counterparts did, the Ottomans carried cutting-edge military technology with them into this broader world. They fought wars in Yemen and Ethiopia, bringing with them gunpowder, handguns, and cannon of great sophistication. Their naval technology was good enough to directly challenge the Portuguese. Ottoman-sponsored corsairs did enormous damage to the Portuguese spice trade in the Indian Ocean. Just as the Spanish and Portuguese did, the Ottoman state tapped the flow of seaborne revenue coming from this wider commercial world. State-sponsored voyages to pick up spice cargoes in Yemen enriched both Ottoman officials and the administration, especially in Egypt. And Ottoman commercial agents ventured even further afield, setting up shop in Hormuz on the Persian Gulf, Calicut in India, and even Indonesia. At its high point, right at the end of Suleiman's reign, an Ottoman naval expedition, and not a small one, went as far as Sumatra to fight the Portuguese on behalf of the Sultanate of Aceh. Finally, this contact with the distant corners of the Muslim world broadened Ottoman intellectual horizons and expanded their sense of what was out there, just as it did for their European counterparts. At least until the end of the 16th century, and definitely during Suleiman's reign, the Ottomans were in no sense behind the expanding powers of Europe. They were part and parcel of the age of exploration. As we'll see and discuss more in the coming months, Suleiman's reign didn't end happily. His son and only viable successor, Selim II, wasn't much like his father. Selim preferred booze and the indolence of the palace to the active life most previous sultans had enjoyed. The last years of Suleiman's rule were taken up with managing the conflict between his sons, mourning the loss of his beloved wife, Hürrem, and a succession of expensive, not entirely successful campaigns. Most notable of these was the disastrous siege of Malta in 1565, which we'll spend an entire episode on as we wrap up the early modern period. The Magnificent died on his final campaign deep into Hungary in 1566. His death was such a destabilizing event that it was kept secret until his corpse could be returned to Istanbul and Selim could take power as smoothly as possible. So this brings us back around to our fundamental question. Did the greatness of the Ottoman Empire die with Suleiman? Was it really a decline after this? This is the essence of the Ottoman decline thesis that we've roundly rejected. Suleiman's reign was a high point in a few different ways. Suleiman himself was a masterful ruler who, by both the standards of his age and those that followed, accomplished a great deal. He conquered, he led his armies into battle, he added new territories, he defeated his imperial foes, he secured favorable treaties, he ordered Ottoman expansion into the Red Sea and Indian Ocean. He codified the laws. He restored a sense of justice and equity after the, shall we say, up and down record of his father's reign. All of these things earned Suleiman his reputation. Of course, as we've noted, it wasn't all happy. Suleiman murdered his most promising son. He oversaw an open civil war between the two remaining potential heirs and then had the other son executed. He allowed power to slip out of his hands and into those of powerful court officials and the women of the harem. But did all of that amount to a decline, as Ottoman commentators of the later 16th and 17th centuries so consistently argued? Was Suleiman's reign really the high point against which everything else has to be measured? The answer to that is a resounding no. The Ottoman Empire changed. It had to change. No empire can remain a conquest state forever, constantly adding new territories, governing those huge territories from the army camp and the battlefield, as Suleiman and his predecessors had done so successfully. War was changing, something we've talked about a great deal on this show. Wars were getting longer and more expensive, more intensive in their consumption of material resources and manpower, conducted at greater distances from the core territories of all the major players of the era. The Ottomans had been way ahead of the curve when it came to tapping their available resources for these purposes. Their military administration was superior, their tax system was more organized, they were able to maintain a larger and more effective standing army, and they rarely had to go deep into debt to fight wars the way the powers of Christian Europe routinely did. Charles V was perpetually penniless. Suleiman rarely had a budget deficit. But by the end of Suleiman's reign, the gap was closing. Other European states had improved their bureaucracies, their mechanisms of state finance, and most of all, they had increased their ambition. The Ottomans had lost their obvious advantage and signs of strain, the same kinds of strain that had plagued European states earlier in the century, began to appear. Loans and budget deficits became more common. Yet even so, the Ottomans were still a major force. The long war of 1593 to 1606 between the Habsburgs and the Ottomans, mostly in Hungary, was at worst a stalemate. The Ottomans were still the undisputed masters of siege warfare for much of the 17th century. They nearly took Vienna again in 1683. The Ottoman decline, such as it was, didn't truly appear until the opening of the 18th century at the earliest, maybe even the middle of the century. So, Suleiman's reign wasn't the beginning of the end. It did herald the end of the first phase of Ottoman history, the conquest phase and mark the transition to consolidation, the long-term and ultimately sustainable rule. That was a major shift, but it wasn't decline. I hope you've enjoyed our mini-series on the Ottoman Empire. It's been a ton of fun for me to step outside my comfort zones and explore something new and exciting. When we return to Tides of History, we'll be heading back toward a place and a figure we're a little more familiar with. Charles V, Holy Roman Emperor and King of Spain, the most powerful Christian ruler of the 16th century. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about here on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left us a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Leah Sutherland and Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.